Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking with Norman Solomon about his brand new book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. The book is free online at blueroad.info. It includes wonderful cartoons by Matt Worker. Norman Solomon is the National Director of Roots Action, where I also work, and Executive Director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's the author of more than a dozen books, many of them previously discussed on this program, including War Made Invisible and War Made Easy. Norman Solomon, welcome back to Talk World Radio.
Hey, thanks a lot, David.
So I love this new book. I want to talk about as much of it as we can fit into the program, but I'm remarking at the fact that this book is columns that you wrote in real time over the past several years, and you haven't edited them to fix mistakes and bad predictions, and yet they still hold up. And I can't think of a single corporate media outlet where you could do anything similar, where you could go back and show past articles or op-eds or programming and not have it be, you know, shameful and ridiculous. Am I right?
Well, erasing the past, I think, is part of the standard operating procedure of politicians and corporate media, because so much of the hindsight is to pretend that it wasn't fairly obvious what was true in real time. And so, for instance, when you and I and so many other progressives were demanding that the United States not attack Iraq, we're talking, almost a quarter century ago, we kept saying, where's the evidence? This is clearly fabrication. And now, after it became clear that the war was not even in establishment terms a good idea per se, although the weapons manufacturers kept making a killing, then it was this myth that, oh, everybody thought at the time. And so if we look at the current era of political machinations, just as with the weapons of mass destruction myth that was used to supposedly justify the invasion of Iraq, we have all sorts of myths like, oh, everybody knew that Hillary Clinton could have beat Trump, and there was nobody warning, or very few people who mattered were warning, that when you have a corporate flack who's taking six figures for one Wall Street speech, maybe that candidate for president isn't actually going to be convincing as a champion of the working class. So, you know, we can walk through so many things that have happened in the last 10 years, large and not so large, where hindsight now is basically an Orwellian rewriting of history from corporate media. And as you're alluding to, David, if we just go back and frozen in amber what many activists and progressive journalists were saying at the time, then it demystifies the whole train of history that we're on.
I want to jump a little ahead and then come back to the beginning of the book and try to look at it in chronological order. But I'm struck by the fact that when we do manage to remember something, they call it an illness, you know, the Iraq syndrome, when people remembered how bad the war on Iraq was and you couldn't actually elect a past supporter of that war president, and it sort of wore off. And Biden was an Iraq war supporter who you were able to elect president. And when you get to the part about Biden, I'm just really struck by the fact that it was time for a flip-flop from one party to the other. You vote in whichever party's not screwing you at the moment. And it was such a wasted opportunity to put in somebody like Biden when you could have put in somebody worth putting in there.
Well, it really is erasure of history that's so standard. It's sort of a drumbeat. We're accustomed to it. It seems like the rhythm of how coverage happens. And so in the case of Joe Biden, I mean, certainly you and I and others at Roots Action were warning back towards the end of the last decade, when the 2020 race was coming into view, that Biden had a history. And some leaders, quote unquote leaders, do change over time, but usually they pretty much stay in the same groove. And so we were pointing out that Biden had a groove. He was very pro-war for a very, very long time. He was working avowedly and thanking segregationist senators for fighting busing for racial integration. He was very much an advocate of beefing up the prison industrial complex with billions of dollars to throw low-income, disproportionately people of color into prisons for a long time. He had a terrible history with the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings that he chaired and helped get this horrible Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas onto the bench, where he still, alas, is, rather than floating off to a peaceful retirement. And so, as you mentioned, we also were emphasizing a part of history that, again, was disappeared afterwards when it wasn't convenient, that Biden chaired these pivotal hearings in the middle of 2002, where he excluded skeptics about the scenario for invading Iraq. So again, he gets a pass. And it was clear that the establishment, the Democratic Party establishment, wanted him as a 2020 candidate. And I have a piece in the Blue Road to Trump Hell where there's a rather wry headline that the blue chip investments on Biden perhaps were not panning out. And so the Wall Street folks who were not Republicans were looking around for a possible replacement because their investment in Joe wasn't panning out. So would it be Harris? Would it be Buttigieg? Then thanks to James Clyburn, the power broker in South Carolina, when Joe Biden's campaign was resuscitated after a fifth place, 8% finish in the New Hampshire primary in early 2020, then so Biden's candidacy was resuscitated and the rest is history. I have a piece in there, and as you note, I didn't revise for hindsight. I have to say there isn't much in the book that I would revise for hindsight, but I did say, well, you know, there's a really good chance Biden can't win in 2020. Well, he did squeak through, but it was a foreshadowing of the disaster that he brought upon the world, really, and certainly including the United States, when his Shakespearean King Lear sort of madness caused him to insist that he had to run for re-election. And of course, at Roots Action, we launched Don't Run Joe campaign, and we couldn't get a single politically oriented, electorally oriented other national organization to join with us because it was a sheep thing. And so you just had to follow the Democratic Party leader off the cliff. And I'm old enough to remember in real time, I was a teenager, I'd read the Washington Post, and during the Vietnam War, 1964, 65, 66, where, oh, we have to follow the leader off the cliff into massive carnage. And we've seen this again and again, sometimes more massive than others. You know, you just go through the history where the mass media, corporate owned and advertised media, the political leaders of both parties just went along with it and stoked the fires for war. So you go to Vietnam, then you go to the buildup after, and you mentioned this sort of idea of the syndrome. You have this notorious statement where the first President Bush, at the end of the horrific slaughter known as the Gulf War in early 1991, says, "Thank God we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all," which was an idea that, oh, well, that notion of sanity that there are real alternatives to war, it has to dissipate. So thank goodness we've gotten rid of the sanity. Now we're getting rid of what we have called the Vietnam syndrome. So we've killed a lot of people. I think it was 100,000 people in 6 weeks, according to the Pentagon, during the Gulf War in 1991, killing people in Iraq. And then so you had this step up, just we had in the 80s, these smaller and bigger attacks on Grenada, attacked on Panama in 1989, the Gulf War of 1991. Then you have the Bill Clinton administration bombing Iraq year after year. And then we had, of course, the Kosovo, Serbia killing in 1999. That's, you know, just to say something about history that's destroyed. It was an ultimatum given to the Milosevic regime in 1999. It was not a peace offering. It was basically, we're giving you an offer that we know you can't accept, because I think it was Madeleine Albright at that point, the Secretary of State, who said privately, they need some bombing. And so the Rambouillet Accords offered in 1999 to Yugoslavia was nothing but an ultimatum as a prelude to war. And then we go ahead to the second Bush administration, the attack on Afghanistan, which began a 20-year war on that country and occupation, of course, the invasion of Iraq. And now we've had war one in one form after another, the U.S. bombing five or six countries during the Biden administration in the Middle East and also in Africa. So my book, The Blue Road to Trump Hell, talks about how that road has been paved with corporate power, with massive and growing income inequality, and this madness of militarism, as Dr. Martin Luther King called it, that has really propelled this descent into basically fascistic policies coming out of the White House.
We're speaking with Norman Solomon, and the book, which you can find at blueroad.info, is called The Blue Road to Trump Hell, How Corporate Democrats Paved the Way for Autocracy. And it brings us right up through the present, but it starts back with Obama and with the election between Trump and Hillary Clinton, and reminds us of how bad Obama was for the 99% of us who are not gazillionaires. There was also a good deal of militarism in the unpopularity of Obama and of Hillary Clinton. But you get to the election of 2016, and there's a candidate worth paying attention to, and he's shut out. And then the lessons of what had built his popularity are avoided and not learned, right?
There was a real danger of Democratic populism actually prevailing in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016. Bernie Sanders was a candidate who was in the low single digits when he started out campaigning in 2015. And as he gained more and more attention and information capacity that he conveyed to the public, his power really grew to the point that there was tremendous, tremendous fear that he might prevail. And there's a now, I think, notorious or should be notorious instance where when Bernie Sanders was doing so well in the primaries that it looked like he was going to take Michigan, which he turned out he did, the Washington Post published 16 negative articles about Bernie Sanders in 16 hours. And that was also, as today, a time when Jeff Bezos, one of the very richest people on the planet, owned the Washington Post. And it's been rather bemusing to me and a little infuriating to go back and see how many pundits, Chris Cizilla, Margaret Sullivan, who was at the Washington Post at the time, liberal, ostensibly somewhat progressive, sometimes very insightful, really going to the barricades later on in the media, so to speak, when later on, when Bernie ran again, he really challenged the Washington Post, run by Jeff Bezos. And Bernie was saying, this is a media outlet, and corporate media in general is biased against the working class, biased against those who are advocating for working people and want to be working people and the elderly and children. And so these pundits and columnists and journalists, they rushed to the defense of Jeff Bezos and said, oh, nothing that I've ever written has been impinged upon or criticized or prevented from what I wanted to write because of Jeff Bezos. Bezos doesn't intrude in the newsroom. And it's ironic because at that time, the control was more subtle. Since then, we know that in the last election cycle in 2024, Jeff Bezos stepped in and told the editorial board of the Washington Post, no, kill that editorial. The Washington Post will not endorse Harris against Trump. And so it sort of gets rid of the mythology that corporate ownership doesn't impinge on what journalists do. It happens all the time because the owners and the top CEO sort of folks, they hire the top managing editors who hire the other editors who oversee the reporters. And just one other note on this, David, is one of the great, at this point, unsung heroes of journalism of the 20th century in the United States is George Seldes. And I have a quote in the book that any journalist who works for a major media institution or a business-owned institution, when they say, nobody tells me what to write, he says, that's one of the stupidest things that any journalist could ever say, because they're constantly told what they can say and report and not report, but it's more subtle in the more, I was going to say, democratic society. I don't know if that phrase applies anymore, because you can sniff it in the air. You know what is allowed and what isn't allowed through what is done and what isn't done. So it's one of the forms of social control, I think, that not only affects journalists, but really people in the political realm quite often in general.
Yeah, and the choice has already been made, as you say, as to who to hire to be those journalists and who not to hire. In fact, in this book, you look at the headline, you would think it was all about the flaws of the corporate Democrats, but there are really two parties at fault through this whole story. One is the so-called leadership, the corporate militarist Democrats at the top of the Democratic Party, and the other is the corporate media. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between those two villains in this saga.
Yeah, it really plays out very dramatically in terms of what happens in Congress and Capitol Hill, because the people who are in legislative power just routinely take their cues from corporate dominated media. And I include their NPR, PBS, supposed public broadcasting and media outlets. They get a lot of their funding from the business sectors and so forth. And so you got elected officials largely taking their cues about what is possible. And no, this is not an Overton window. This is not feasible because I read it in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and heard it in mass media all the time. And then vice versa, the corporate media folks are taking their cues from the elected officials. So they're in this sort of constrained and often in a war context, macabre dance with each other. And they're using each other as points of reference. And of course, both sectors are getting huge money from the donors, the investors, and so forth from corporate America.
One of the big stories that I think is sort of being forgotten and sort of not that you go through in real time in the book is the Russiagate nonsense, which I still can't believe how incredible it was for there to be this general consensus that Russia had decided a U.S. election without my ever seeing any particular evidence that Russia had determined the outcome of a U.S. election, and it was like grabbing at air, and you would question it, and it wouldn't be a real claim, but then it would be right back in your face on every page of the next edition of the paper that it had happened. What do you make of it?
One of the key aspects that was almost never talked about in mass media is how the Russiagate supposed scandal really serve the interests of corporate Democrats. There's a book called Shattered by a couple of mainstream journalists about the Hillary Clinton campaign of 2016. And they document, and I cite this in the Blue Road to Trump Hell book that I've written, that 24 hours after that terrible election night in 2016, they had a bunch of pizza boxes emptied out at the Hillary Clinton national headquarters, and the people who had run the campaign decided, we're going to blame Russia for the loss of the presidency that has happened for Hillary Clinton. So naturally, they couldn't blame Hillary Clinton, who was claiming as to be a champion of the people when she was taking these big checks from the Wall Street speeches that I mentioned and was in the thrall of corporate America, whose only working class experience, so to speak, was when she was on the board of Walmart several decades ago. They couldn't blame the Wall Street affinity for that was mutual with Hillary Clinton more broadly. And they couldn't blame that the Clinton campaign had been so dismissive of the progressive wing of the party. And so rather than go through all of those things that the campaign leaders didn't want to do, they came on this solution early. We'll blame Russia. We'll create what became very quickly Russiagate. And as you allude to, that went on for years, years and years. It became an orthodoxy. There were some media figures who became stars, Rachel Maddow. Much of her career was built on Russiagate. And one of the great irony is they were talking about Russian oligarchs, and the U.S. oligarchs were just stealing the entire store from the federal government and the taxpayers, and were gaining more and more control. So it was like, don't look over here, look over there. And meanwhile, the right wing, the huge investments that were being made and were paying off by the militarists of the Republican Party who hate democracy, that was just put out of sight. So it's like, don't look here, right in front of you in your own country, that is a place where democracy is being destroyed internally by people in the United States. Look over to Moscow and blame the Kremlin.
And what's the current version? What's the acceptable, respectable corporate Democrat explanation for Kamala Harris losing and congressional candidates losing and the Democratic Party generally being ineffective on pretty much everything at the national level?
At a electoral level, I think some of it tacitly is, well, we just didn't realize how bad Joe Biden would be. He came out of the 2022 midterms, and they weren't as bad as expected for an off-year election for an incumbent in the White House. And so it was a reasonable assumption that he could run again. Of course, books have come out exposing that that was a complete conscious lie that was spun by people at the White House. But I think the narrative is to sort of, it's self-exculpatory, if that's the right phrase, that it wasn't a flaw in the corporate Democratic Party establishment. It was just bad luck and that sort of thing, and a flaw. And of course, now he gets blamed entirely. So it leaves the people running the party off the hook. I have a piece in the book where there was a poll that was taken earlier this year, actually, and it showed that when Democrats who self-identified around the country as registered Democrats were asked, who do you think most exemplifies the future of the Democratic Party that you want? And they were given a list of names. Joe Biden came in at 1%, 1%. And yet one of the leaders, Jane Kleeb, one of the leaders of the DNC, who is the leader of the Association of State Party Democratic Chairs around the country, she was at the same time publicly saying that every state party chair of the Democratic Party would be really happy to have Joe Biden keynote their annual dinners. So you have this huge gap, which is certainly not just peculiar to that incident, because I point out in the book, for instance, if you look at the Gaza war, the genocide on Gaza that Biden and Harris supported and now Trump is supporting, we had overwhelming poll numbers that Democratic voters decided they were opposed to arming Israel. And yet you could hardly find at that time any members of Congress, Democrats, no Republicans and very few Democrats, who would say the same thing. And I think there are other examples where you look at, again, Joe Biden not running, and I, you know, cover this ground a lot in the book, where we had 60, 65, 70% of Democrats around the country saying, we don't want Joe Biden to run again in the polls. And you had about 1% or 2% of the Democrats in Congress saying the same thing. So this is chronic because you have grassroots opinion that is so over on one side, and then you have people in Congress who supposedly represent those with the opinion, and it's diametrically opposite. So something is really screwed up in a supposed democratic system.
We got just a couple minutes left, Norman Solomon. Near the start of the book, you use a phrase that struck me, which was repetition compulsions. I don't know if that's simply a way to summarize the repetitiveness of the mistakes over these decades, or if that's a phenomenon with a certain psychological explanation, but it struck me as very descriptive of the problem. Can you elaborate a little bit?
Politically, the Democratic Party leadership a decade ago and now, they are stuck in what I think we could call a repeated disorder, a repetition compulsion disorder. And the net effect is that the same patterns that were in effect in the middle of the last decade are in effect in the middle of this decade. And that's why I think this history is so important, because the allegiance to corporate power, the allegiance to militarism and war is such that it distances the Democratic Party leadership from the people who they are depending on to defeat Republicans. And that's why, again, I call the book The Blue Road to Trump Hell, because the road is not done. And it could be, we could be talking, David, in a few years, the Blue Road to Vance Hell. I mean, unless this pattern is changed, then preventing this continual fascistic control over society, it won't happen. So I think a logical question that some of our listeners might have is, well, you know, Trump is so terrible, which he is, so why are you talking about the Democratic Party, talking them down? It's because if we don't change the way the Democratic Party functions, then that simply will continue to enable these fascists to gain more and more power.
Indeed. And if we have elections and we have honest elections and the trends continue as they are and everybody tries to throw the bums out by picking the other team, you're going to get Democrats in power. And if they follow the course we've seen in this book, you're going to get Democrats in power who don't do anything for anybody. And pretty soon you're going to have worse than Trump. These are lessons to learn. I wish we could go on for hours, but the book is freely available to all at the website, which is blueroad.info. There is also a newly published autopsy on the Kamala Harris Donald Trump election at the top of rootsaction.org, where Norman Solomon is the national director. Norman, thanks for all of your books and everything you're doing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thanks a lot, David, for all your work, including Talk World Radio.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.